The president has tasked the foreign ministry with negotiating with different countries over the purchase of 60 million doses of COVID vaccines. We hope that this can be achieved by early October. If this happens, we could vaccinate all of the most vulnerable groups within the next 2 months.
In addition to the import of foreign vaccines, Iran is also trying to ramp up the production of domestically made jabs, such as Coviran, which has so far injected more than 1.5 million doses in the country. Nura and Covpars are among the local vaccines that are expected to hit the market in the next few months.
Figures show that every 3 minutes, one Iranian dies of the coronavirus. And this is not the peak yet. Now, as vaccination is viewed as the ultimate terminator of the pandemic, Iran says it will build more such vaccination centers across the country to speed up the so far sluggish inoculation trend in Iran. Yusuf Jalali from the holy city of Mashhad.
Fury raging in the streets of Pakistan on the International Day of Enforced Disappearances that originated in military dictatorship, but the practice continued in subsequent civilian governments.
Victims' families are outraged at Khan administration's inaction over what they call the state kidnapping. Their only request from the government is to prosecute their loved ones in the court of law and follow the due process if they have breached any law.
The protest was organized by Human Rights Commission of Pakistan.
Today we are here in front of Karachi Press Club. As you know, all from all nations, people are here in different regions of Pakistan. They are demanding for the safe release of their loved ones. I am also a victim of enforced disappearance. My father has been kidnapped by the secret forces when he was on his duty.
First post 9/11 reported cases of enforced disappearances was Dr. Afia Siddiqui, who was kidnapped along with her three children in 2003 from the streets of Karachi by CIA with the help of local secret services.
We arrange combined march, united march, along with Shia missing persons, Sindhi missing persons, Baloch missing persons, Pakhtun missing persons. Victim families are sitting here outside the governor house, and they are demanding that if someone is guilty, then give him a trial, fair and free trial in the courts of Pakistan.
We, the Sindhi and the Baloch and the Shia missing persons, Pashtun missing persons, are protesting here. Where we held a march from Gora Kabristan to here, our governor house. We are demanding here from the Riyasat that where are our people, where are our workers, where are our nationalists, who are belong with some kind of parties.
Enforced disappearances is a chronic human rights violation in Pakistan, with more than 7,000 complaints of enforced disappearances since 2011, where the real number might be much higher than the official figure. Mohammad Turi, Karachi.
The International Organization for Migration says Yemen is suffering from the world's worst humanitarian crisis, as more than 15 million Yemenis have no access to safe water and sanitation. The organization maintained it reached 2.1 million of those in need of water and hygiene services.
The war and the siege on Yemen have had a significant impact on the water infrastructure and led to the destruction of a large number of water facilities and sewage treatment plants in Yemen. There are actually a large number of Yemenis who do not have access to clean water, but not at this scale.
Health officials say lack of access to sanitation is the main reason for the spread of cholera that killed thousands of Yemenis, including children, since its outbreak in 2016. They said the new figures herald a new wave of cholera if the international organizations keep turning a blind eye to the catastrophic situation in Yemen.
There are many water and sanitation projects which have been suspended either partially or completely as a result of the war and siege imposed on our country. Most of the organizations do not remain committed to their pledges. The UNICEF is supposed to provide clean water to Yemenis to prevent from a new wave of cholera epidemic and other diseases such as dengue fever and malaria.
Saudi Arabia, along with its regional allies, launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015 and imposed an all-out blockade on the war-torn country. The United Nations describes Yemen as the world's worst man-made humanitarian crisis.
Millions of Yemenis, including children, are at risk of facing a new wave of cholera since they are unable to reach safe water. This has taken place amid the silence of the international organizations. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Young and old, men and women from all walks of life have gathered on the outskirts of Kashmir's summer capital, Srinagar, to commemorate Yom Hussein, or the Day of Imam Hussein. This is one of the events organized across Kashmir Valley every year during the Muslim calendar month of Muharram to discuss the significance of Imam Hussein's sacrifice to uphold Islamic teachings, truth and justice. The event brings together more than 100 Islamic scholars from different parts of Kashmir.
Imam Hussein's personality cannot be defined. We have tried for the last 1400 years to carry forward his teachings and his values. And with passing time, we have seen more and more people are joining the caravan of Hussein. Imam Hussein is an epitome of greatness, and his sacrifice for Islamic teachings and values teaches the way forward. The first step is unity among Muslims.
The scholars urge the youth to go deep into the pages of Islamic history to understand the sacrifices Imam Hussein made.
Imam Hussein, Muharram and Karbala have a message, and we have come to promote that message. The events of Karbala teaches us to be steadfast. They teach us the values of sacrifice for truth. They teach us not to give up and not to bow down. They teach us how Imam Hussein and his companions won the battle of Karbala, despite losing their lives. Today, 1400 years have passed, and we have carried the events of Karbala in our hearts and will carry it to our younger generation and won't let anyone forget the greatest sacrifice for the humanity.
The Islamic scholars also reminded people of plots being hatched by enemies of Islam and urged Muslims to stay united.
The enemies of Islam intend to divide us across communal lines. The majority of non-Muslims think Shias and Sunnis are at odds. They call Shia Muslims Husseinis and Sunni Muslims Mohammedans. And this is deliberate. It is aimed at creating a rift among Muslims to divide us, to divide our faith. Hussein alayhi salam is Prophet Muhammad's grandson. So how come we are divided? Such conferences aim to enlighten people about the nefarious designs of enemies and to teach the importance of unity among Muslims.
Religious scholars say the Battle of Karbala was a defining moment in the history of Islam that continues to inspire people regardless of their religion. And the real tribute to the martyrs of Karbala would be to follow their path in letter and spirit. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hussein Amir Abdullahian arrived in Damascus on Sunday. He sat down with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and discussed with him steps taken by both sides to enhance bilateral cooperation with the aim of reaching a higher level of partnership in economy and trade. In the meeting, Assad reaffirmed that the ongoing cooperation between the two countries had positive results in terms of protecting the interests of the two peoples, mainly in fighting terrorism. Abdullahian, for his part, briefed Assad on the outcome of the Baghdad Cooperation and Partnership Conference. He asserted that Iran will continue to support Syria in fighting all forms of terror, mainly economic terrorism.
Both countries are working on a roadmap to develop relations as well as trade and economic cooperation to tackle the sanctions imposed on them. We discussed the latest developments in the region. Improving economic cooperation between both countries' private sector is an important issue which both sides regard as crucial.
The Iranian official also held a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart Faisal al-Maqdad. They discussed regional and international developments, saying that foreign presence in the region will not bring security and stability. Maqdad underlined the importance of steadfastness in the face of all Western plots and pressure in order to achieve victory.
We discussed bilateral relations, the situation in Syria and Iran, as well as mutual challenges, the steadfastness of Syria and Iran, as well as all those who want to achieve justice, freedom, sovereignty and independence in our world. We lead them to victory over terrorism and those who question our capability to face challenges.
Abdullahian concluded his meetings by holding talks with heads of Syria-based Palestinian factions, renewing Iran's support for Palestinians' struggle and their fight for their legitimate rights.
Mr. Abdullahian's visit comes shortly after the formation of the new cabinet in Iran. The visit is a reiteration of Iran's steadfast stance towards Syria, based on support to the government and people in the fight on terror and for rebuilding the country. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
In a first conference, Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip declared the return of nighttime protests, also known as night confusion operations along the buffer zone, to reject the Israeli blockade on the enclave.
It is time to end this crippling siege completely. We gave the mediators many chances to end this siege, and there are no more chances for any delay. Our people have got enough of the suffering. We will not leave our positions and won't stop the confrontation until Israel ends the blockade. Israeli settlers nearby won't witness peace as long as our people are not living in peace. We won't stay silent over the misery our people live in.
Palestinian protesters staged a demonstration near the buffer zone, burning tires and launching incendiary balloons at the Israeli army. The demonstrators were voicing their anger at the deteriorating quality of life in the Gaza Strip, caused by a crippling Israeli blockade since 2007. On Saturday, 13-year-old Omar Hassan Abu Nil died of injuries after being shot by the Israeli soldiers during an anti-Israeli protest held a week before.
If the Israeli regime keeps committing these crimes against our people, we will continue the fight and confront the regime here. Israel should know that we are only fighting for our right to live a decent life. This is our land, and we won't leave it, no matter the cost.
Palestinian Resistance Front says it will escalate clashes with Israel as long as the regime keeps its suffocating siege on Gaza, hampering life in the impoverished enclave. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi,
sir. Hi, kitty. Good morning. Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Thank you.
The Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. The Israeli regime has swept into many areas, arresting young Palestinians because they are the most active in resisting Israeli occupation. Many of the youths who were arrested have received harsh sentences of 25 years in jail. Some are facing life. Others have not been charged but are still languishing away in jail. This is human rights, Israeli style. We've earlier talked to our correspondent in the occupied West Bank, and she shed some light on Israel's crackdown on Palestinians. Let's take a listen at what she had to say.
We are speaking about 1,900 Palestinians were arrested in Al-Quds, dozens of them. Of course, we are speaking about hundreds of Palestinian minors. Dozens of those 1,900 are under the age of 14. It's against all international laws, according to Palestinian human rights as well as international human rights. So it's an attempt to intimidate them as well as to prevent any Palestinian to be engaged in the different forms of resistance, struggle, or activities against Israeli occupation. In addition to those arrests, since the beginning of 2021, Palestinian human rights said that all over the occupied West Bank, 1,000 Palestinian miners were detained by the Israeli forces. 130 Palestinian women were detained by the Israeli soldiers across the occupied territories. This brings the number of Palestinians who are still languishing in the Israeli jails of over 4,500 Palestinians, because the Israeli forces, the Israeli authorities, use the policy that's known as the revolving door. So at the time they release Palestinians who end their terms in Israeli jails, every day they storm and raid Palestinian areas to continue arresting more Palestinians across the occupied territories.
Well, I'd like to welcome my guests to the spotlight. Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Mick Napier out of Edinburgh. And from the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masood Shajere out of London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with us here on the Spotlight. Well, let's start this off with Mick. Israel embarks on night raids of villages, trying to cause as much fear and confusion as possible for Palestinians. They arrest young adults and many times even children and hold them without even charging them. I mean, what does all of this mean, that nothing is being done against this?
No, your question contains the answer. The whole point is to instill fear and to terrorize the captive population of the West Bank. There was actually a group of quite prominent Zionist lawyers went to the West Bank a couple of years ago from London, very prestigious, big names, too expensive for me to be able to hire. And they came back absolutely shocked and stunned. And they said, look, this system is not a legal system at all. There's a 99.7% conviction rate. The whole purpose is to instill fear and terror into the Palestinian people, to demoralize and crush them. That is my view, but I'm talking about the views of a group of Zionist high-flying lawyers who went there and came back and could not ignore that truth. The Israelis have a very big toolbox. One is jailing people. And as I say, the system they have is 99.7%. They also jail hundreds of people without trial. I forget the lady's name, but the woman who was ready to give birth in an Israeli prison a couple of days ago, or maybe she's delivered, I don't know. But she was jailed under legislation from the British era, which simply means you can be jailed because the authorities don't like you. They don't need to present evidence. And these 6 month maximum jailings can be rolled over one, two, three, seven, 11 times. And so people live in a lawless situation. It's best to think of it as a situation of complete lawlessness. When a Palestinian approaches an Israeli checkpoint, his or her fate depends entirely upon the mood of an Israeli private or sergeant or whatever, and how that individual feels determines the life chances, the fate of a Palestinian. To have his ID confiscated because the soldier thinks he's impertinent or looks at him in the wrong way, that can wreck his life, can reduce his family from poverty to utter destitution because he loses his job. So the Palestinians live under this regime, which is designed to terrorize them into leaving. It's really quite simple at one level, although it's quite sophisticated in its delivery.
Okay. Well, Masoud, the regime in Tel Aviv appears to be getting even more aggressive with an increase in trying to depopulate Palestinian areas and convert them into settler areas. I mean, your take on all of this?
Well, Mick is absolutely right, you know, of the picture. But I think we should stop looking at just this particular clip of what is happening during the last 12 months or last year. This has been going on for the last 70 years, over 70 years. Ethnic cleansing, genocidal act, abuse of individual, creating fear as a tool of controlling masses. It's been going on for a very long time. And we all know that not just those who are in under occupation in Palestine, but indeed even the rest of us in the so-called civilized West, Europe and America and everywhere else, we actually are demonized and, you know, seen as identified and promoted as a terrorist or anti-Semite just because we support the right of Palestinians to live as a human being. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, we know from our experience to stand up against the oppressors, there is a price to pay. But the reality is that if we are not all willing to pay that price, united in collective way, then that price becomes much more. It will end up killing people, pregnant women, children, elderly, their houses being demolished. This is happening day in, day out. And indeed, the rest of us need to stand up. We actually have to sort of make this a priority. We cannot have peace in the region without resolving this illegal, oppressive, occupying, sort of illegal occupation and the colonialism. That has to come an end for the region to start moving away from these violence. These violence by the Israeli Zionist state is not just being done by a small group of people. Systematically, youth, Zionist youth, Israeli youth are actually taught how to hate and how to conflict sort of damage on ordinary Palestinian and continued ethnic cleansing. We need to look at the whole picture. We need to look at what has been going on, not just last year, but for whole 70 years. And the international community has to take responsibility.
Okay.
Unless that's done, we are going to see more of this, and indeed more people are going to be silent. And then the price for the rest of those who are standing against this operation, it will become much more heavy price to pay.
Well, Mick, young Palestinians are giving their lives on an almost daily basis, trying to free their people from this occupation, and still there is not the major international condemnation that should be taking place. I want you to explain that, especially now that Masoud was just talking about the international community and their need basically to step up to the plate.
Let's talk about two international communities. Let's talk about one, our political elites and corporate elites as well, who tend to be in strong support of Israel. But the Israelis also know very clearly that public opinion is swinging against them massively. And I think we should ask why, when Israel attacked the Palestinians, you know, just a couple of months ago, when the Al-Aqsa Mosque was under threat, when fascist gangs were roving inside 48 and attacking Palestinians, and when families were being thrown onto the street in East Jerusalem, when the resistance in Gaza came to the support of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and fired barrages of rockets into their own land, their own territory called Palestine, which Israel occupies at the moment, It's quite interesting that Israel did not go as far as they did with Operation Protective Edge or Cast Lead. They stopped after a relatively short period of, and I'm sorry to say this, after killing only 100 or so Palestinians. Previously they had killed 1,000 or 2,000 in these terrible massacres, the periodic massacres that they carry out. Why? I think Israel realized that it was headed for a disaster, that this was a political disaster for Israel, and the deep unpopularity that Israel is in public opinion was getting worse and worse and worse. Look, there are two extra dimensions to this I would add to what Masoud says. One is the political tradition in Israel today, which was represented by Netanyahu and by the other dominant groups now, they don't think that they only deserve Palestine. They think that they also deserve Jordan. Their appetites are not restricted to the Jordan River. And the Palestinians, with their blood and the incredible heroism that you've just mentioned, the fact that these young men and young women continue to resist, they are not just defending Palestine. They're defending the peoples of the entire region, because the appetites of the Zionists don't stop at the Jordan River. The other dimension that I would add, if I may, is that one of the reasons it's gone on for so long, certainly the last 4 or 5 decades, is that it makes money. That the Palestinians are not only cruelly abused, they are monetized by the Zionist state. Because the weapons, many of the weapons that were used in Afghanistan as part of the spending of $2 trillion, which ultimately was unsuccessful, but many of those weapons were tested on Palestinians and then sold by Israel to the USA. So the occupation can be a moneymaker for the Israelis. And it's also a moneymaker in a slightly lesser way. They charge, the Israelis steal most of the aid which is destined for Palestinians as humanitarian aid. And even if you speak to a Palestinian prisoner, you started off talking about the prisoners, if you're a prisoner in the Israeli dungeons, they feed you pig's wool. But if the families pay money, and it's a fair amount of money for their loved ones in these dungeons, they can be given better food. So, no, anything that resembles international law is violated by the Israelis, and mm-hmm. they even abuse the prisoners, not just in terms of cruel torture, which has been researched and shown by many, many bodies, but even at the level of depriving them of decent food, unless their families cough up extra money. Okay. It's blackmail all round. So yes, Masoud's right. This is a brutal system that's gone on for many, many decades, but it's got a certain grisly stability because of this money-making aspect to it.
Well, Masoud, what does all of this do to the psyche of young Palestinians, especially growing up with this backdrop day in, day out? Checkpoints, apartheid wall, night raids, demolition of homes, not having access to clean water or little electricity. I mean, what does this do to their psyche day in and day out?
Well, they realize, if they haven't realized before, they realize now that the only one they could rely on is themselves. Palestinians have got no other option than to resist this illegal, brutal occupation, this sort of colonial abuses that is taking place day in, day out. And, it takes place despite whatever the Palestinians do. This is an ethnic cleansing systematically in place. And I just want to add one more thing to what Mick was saying, mm-hmm. and that is that Israel needs to create fear among its own citizens to justify this illegal, brutal occupation and this Zionism, and that actually is the need of this state. This illegal state is in need of conflict. Without conflict, it will not be able to justify its existence. And so this is going to go on, and Palestinians have got no other option. The real point is what the rest of us are going to do. Are we going to rise up and support the Palestinians, and how far we will go, and do we allow the lobby, the Zionist lobby, what they do in Britain and in the United States and elsewhere, what they did with Jeremy Corbyn, what they're doing with the Jewish sort of pro-Palestinians in Labour Party and elsewhere. Do we allow that to continue, or do we all unite and stand together? We are doing a good job, and actually I think we need to do more. We need to realize that, as Mick was saying, their days are outnumbered. The fact of the matter is more ordinary people are seeing the brutality of what's going on for what it is, and this sort of empty propaganda that this Zionist state is the only democracy in the region, it really is such a joke, but most people are waking up to the reality that is not the case, and we need to continue this resistance united and creating a better society and justice society for everyone in the region. And I think that's the way forward.
What about that, Mick? More people are waking up. Your take on that, and is that a sign of actually Israel not no longer being able to totally control the narrative as they have been? And is this a sign of waning power coming out of Tel Aviv?
It's much better than that. Not only are they unable to control the narrative, they've lost the narrative completely. If you and I are having a discussion, a debate, and it becomes pretty heated and it's very serious, and at a certain point in time I say, don't let her speak, it's because I've lost the argument. If I'm winning the argument, I don't need to silence you. I will carry on winning. Israel wants to silence Massoud, myself, everybody who speaks up for Palestine, without exception, and they want to silence these people because they have lost the argument comprehensively. When we started talking about 20 years ago about Israeli apartheid, we were of lone voices. Very few people would agree with us. And some people who were pro-Palestine said, oh, you're going too far. It's bad, but it's not apartheid. The argument is won. We've won the argument in terms of mainstream, decent, enlightened, and also indifferent public opinion. Israel has lost it. To call Israel an apartheid state, nobody raises an eyebrow. Of course it is. Jewish-only roads, two legal systems, one for Jews and one for Palestinians. It's not a discussion any longer. And you can tell this because Human Rights Watch, not a radical body, or the major Israeli human rights organization, B'Tselem, has come out openly to say Israel is a system based on Jewish supremacy from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean, not just in the West Bank, but everywhere the Israeli foot falls. So yes, they have lost the argument. The question is, how quickly can we turn this into such action that our elites, who are currently selling weapons to Israel, will be forced to do what they did with South Africa and abandon a regime whose only crime ever in their eyes will be to fail. You see, the South African regime, the corrupt regime that was ruling in Kabul until recently, the only crime they have that's recognized is failure. But once you fail, then you'll be discarded. We need to turn public opinion into, like gas needs a piston to move, to channel it into effective solidarity. But we don't need to fight for public opinion. Israel's lost that already. The fight is to channel it into BDS activity.
What about that, Massoud? What does it take to expand this fight? Mick said that the argument has already been won. Now it's a matter of convincing the elites to stop supporting, the political elites to stop supporting that apartheid regime, and also increase pressure from civil society. Tell me, what is it going to take?
Everything, really. BDS, we need to boycott everything Israeli and all the companies who are supporting the State of Israel. And they're extremely scared of this. But we need to continue it. We need to actually do it religiously. We need to put pressure on the politicians. The politicians in so-called democracies in the West and Europe and the United States are going against the masses. The masses are becoming more pro-Palestinian while the elite and the company is becoming more pro-Israeli. There are reasons for that. Mick mentioned some of it is economy and everything else. But we need to extend our work, and we need to expose every atrocity being committed by this Zionist state. And we need to actually make it as such, like South Africa, that people will be ashamed of supporting and associating with such a regime. When we achieve that, we have actually finally won the whole thing, not just the argument among the civil society. We have gone all the way, and it will be end of this oppressive regime.
And Mick, do you think that we're getting closer to that day?
Who knows? Nobody knows. Nobody predicted a week before that the Berlin Wall would fall. Nobody could predict when the Shah of Iran would fall. You could say he will fall, but nobody could predict the time. It has never been possible in a struggle against a brutal regime. It has never been possible to predict the hour or even the year of its fall. It will fall because it's unsustainable. The Palestinians will continue to pay a very, very high price. That price can be lowered by the peoples of the Middle East and the peoples around the world coming to the support of the Palestinians.
Okay, and
but
on
it
that
will
note,
continue to be a cruel struggle.
On that note, I thank both of you for being with me. We're out of time. Scottish, from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Mick Napier of Edinburgh, and the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajarit, out of London. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. As sovereign nations, indigenous groups, and Native American tribes are using their authority to make their own rules to protect students and teachers as COVID-19 cases surge. We're prepared for you an article written by Halle Golden. The piece is titled Native American Tribes Enforce Mask Mandates Regardless of State Bans. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Please stay with us for more of Halle Golden's article. Native American tribes across the handful of U.S. states with bans on school mask mandates have asserted their powers as sovereign nations to defy the orders, with some also implementing their own testing and vaccine directives for tens of thousands of students and faculty in schools on their reservations as COVID-19 cases surge. Under America's Constitution, federally recognized tribes such as the Navajo Nation and the Cherokee Nation have self-governing authority, and so have been able to implement mask mandates despite the statewide bans. Jason Dropick, board president of the National Indian Education Association and the head of the Indian Community School in Wisconsin, said the majority of Native communities he had heard from in states with these bans have implemented mask mandates. He explained the reasoning often had to do with the fact that the indigenous Americans have had to deal with a disproportionately high death toll from COVID. According to an analysis released in February, one in every 475 Native Americans has died since the pandemic started, a greater proportion relative to any other demographic in the country. Jason Dropick said, "When we have loss, and we have it every year, even outside of a pandemic, but when you increase that amount of loss, there are ways of being that just don't continue to be taught, and that can be lost completely." He added, "It's not solely a matter of someone's life, which is in and of itself hugely impactful, but also those ways of being, cultural traditions, language, and work that also sometimes pass with our native speakers." State leaders in Oklahoma, Utah, Arizona, Iowa, and South Carolina have implemented bans on mask mandates in schools. The Education Department's Civil Rights Enforcement Arm announced on Monday, 30th of August, that it had launched an investigation into five states to determine whether their ban on mask mandates is discriminatory against students with disabilities. Leaders in Florida, Texas, Arkansas have also added bans, but due to legal challenges, they either are not enforcing those bans or have been blocked completely. The Navajo Nation, the U.S.'s largest tribe, reaffirmed a mask mandate at the beginning of August for the 133 schools with students from preschool to 12th grade on its reservation, covering more than 27,000 square miles in Utah, Arizona, and New Mexico. The Navajo Nation president, Jonathan Nez, said students and staff have diligently followed the requirement. He said, as of recent days, there has been no evidence of COVID spread within the schools so far this school year. The president of the Navajo Nation, Jonathan Nez, attributed this success in part to COVID not being politicized inside the tribe, but rather framed in a historical context as the latest monster plaguing the community that must be vanquished. He said, "With any war, any battles, you've got to be equipped and you've got to have your armor. And you've got to have your weapons," he added. "And one of the armors that we have is the vaccine. And one of the weapons that we have is wearing face masks and using hand sanitizers. And so we framed it in that way to where our elders can understand what we're dealing with. And they assisted and helped us talk to our younger generation." The Meskwaki Settlement School, which is property of the Sac and Fox tribe of the Mississippi and is the only federally recognized native tribe in Iowa, also announced a mask requirement for students and staff. And in Arizona, the Hopi tribe and the White Mountain Apache tribe mandated masks in schools. COVID cases on the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma have risen sharply since July, with weekly case totals reaching more than 1,000 in August. Over the summer, tribal leaders made the decision to implement a mask requirement for hundreds of students in its high school and immersion school for the new school year. They also included weekly COVID testing requirements in the schools and vaccination mandates for extracurricular activities. The Cherokee Nation Principal Chief, Chuck Hoskin Jr., describes schools as some of the safest places you can go in the area thanks to these protocols. He said there have been only 2 cases of COVID documented this school year. But more than 95% of students on the reservation attend an Oklahoma public school, which, although located on the reservation, is not run by indigenous leaders. The Cherokee Nation Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin described the situation as frustrating and said he couldn't recall any other time when the tribe's school system took a different approach on health from Oklahoma public schools. He said, in terms of the operations and basic things like health and safety, it has never frankly occurred to me as a tribal leader that the schools operating within our reservation by the state would fall so woefully short of such a basic health and safety measure. He added, COVID and the law pushed the governor, Kevin Stitt, has changed all that, of course, and I hope it's an anomaly. He added, unfortunately, even if it is an anomaly, it's coming at a great cost. Tahlequah, Oklahoma, which is the capital of the Cherokee Nation, the Tahlequah Public School Superintendent reported recently that in the first 10 days of school, they saw over 100 cases of COVID. Later in the week, the schools opted to move all elementary sites to distance learning until 3rd of September due to staff shortages and rising cases for both staff and students. Other tribes in these regions have faced similar situations in which the schools their students attend do not fall under the jurisdiction of the tribe. For example, the Cheyenne and the Arapaho tribes do not have any reservation land, so students attend public schools in Oklahoma. The Cheyenne and the Arapaho Department of Education Executive Director Carrie Whitlow explained that although the tribes take a serious stance on COVID safety protocols, there have been mask mandates for children over 5 years old and teachers, and testing and vaccination requirements for teachers in its 2 childcare centers and 3 Head Start centers. Its leaders have not had a say when it comes to rules in public schools. She said, "We're really trying to do our best," adding, "However, because of our lack of authority in public school districts, they don't really seek the advice of us from a tribe and tribal education department, as far as our students and their families, and how do we protect them. But tribal leaders have continued to make sure students always have access to face masks and understand the importance of them." Earlier this month, the education department's Facebook page featured a message from Whitlow wishing students a safe and healthy school year. She added, "Please do your best to protect your homes and communities by wearing face masks."
morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.